Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water, all the way from San Diego, it's Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, happy end of season, mate. Happy transfer window. Here we are. We've reached the end of another season. Should we thank everyone for sticking with us through, like, another whole season? We've done loads of these now. We're, like, tried and tested. We're old hats.
We're old school at this point. I was thinking this. So I watched the Champions League final in a pub in the Cotswolds where I'd taken Lucy for her birthday. And there were all these kids who had obviously just finished their A-levels or just kind of done first year of uni, all these things. And they were talking about all these wicked trips. They were like, oh, I'm going to go to Barcelona to see Elro. And I was like, oh, I love doing that kind of thing. And I was thinking about trying to join the conversation, but I was really concerned they might call me Unks. So I was like, there's nothing sadder. I was like, actually, we're well old hat at this point. Like, we've actually quietly become old at that time.
Mate, I really have been old, turned of age in this podcast. So 10 years older than you, mate. Oh, old man over it. Anyway, it was a great season.
17th episode of Ranks.
It's what?
The 317th episode of Ranks on this main feed. And when you add that to the fact that we've also done 567 episodes over on the Patreon. We're coming up to the big 1,000, mate. So we're coming up. That's kind of wild.
That's if we remember that it's coming up, that's going to be a big episode. There's a chance we miss it.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those. That's a lot of episodes. That's a lot of content.
Mate, like, we haven't talked about it actually on this side of the podcast, but on Patreon, we get a lot of people messaging recently talking about how they are growing up with the pod. And, you know, we've talked about how people have, like, graduated, got their first job, got married and things like that, like all in the time. And they're like, you've been with me all the way. Like, I've gone from boy to man listening to Ranks. And, like, we're having them, like, literally every week on the post box on Patreon at the moment. That's my favorite thing, I think, about this pod. It really is. And then occasionally you bump into someone. I heard you bumped into someone the other day.
I did.
Jamie.
I bumped into Jamie in London Bridge.
I've bumped into him at Waterloo before.
So there you go. We had a good chat about Chelsea. We had a great conversation. It was the day after they'd won the Conference League. So yeah, just bumped into him in pub in London Bridge. It was lovely.
Like, that's cool.
Just the magic moments, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I've had it out here too. Like, I bumped into more people actually in San Diego that listen to Ranks than I ever did in London. And it's just great. Like, and I'm sure people feel weird about coming over, but just do it. You don't feel weird. Like, it's really cool. And I'm happy to, like, say hello to you, more than happy. Cause, like, you're a big part, you're as big a part of this podcast as we are. Cause if you didn't listen, we wouldn't do it. So, well, we might actually. We might do it on our own, just chatting to each other. How many listens this week, Jack? Zero, mate. Never mind.
Two, you and me. No, but thank you to everyone for sticking with us through another season. It's been a busy season. And I know this is the point sometimes. And I think for a lot of people, it feels like football fatigue has started to settle in a little bit. You know, we're seeing some interesting things with the Club World Cup. And I know this is where you come alive, DJ, and the transfer windows begin and all of those things. And look, for some people, this is the most exciting part of the season. And that's totally fair enough because of all the kind of what ifs and what comes next and the chance to reset. And I get that completely, especially if your team hasn't had such a brilliant season, you know, this kind of opportunity to hit the blank slate and go again. But also, I think there is a lot of people who are like, I'm a bit worn out at the moment and just want a breather. So if you're still listening, you've listened through the entire season, or if this is your first episode, welcome along. Thank you for being a part of this and thank you for sticking with us through another season. It really does mean the world to us.
Yeah, definitely, man. It's been fun. And we've got one last Champions League takeaway to come right now, right? We haven't talked about what happened at the weekend.
No, we haven't. You did something on the Patreon where you worked through some hot takes from
some of the
But I loved it. I really, really enjoyed the episode. It was, I like that you wanted to do it while it was hot. Strike whilst the iron was there. And it was a great episode because there were some wild thoughts. There were some brilliant thoughts from the rank squad.
There
and
were.
The way that you work through that, I mean, what a performance. I think first and foremost, right? Let's get stuck into this because it was, and I've seen a lot of people talking about the fact that Inter weren't very good. And that's fine. But they weren't allowed to be very good by the complete and utter whirlwind, this maelstrom that was this PSG team. They were absolutely everywhere. And I think you can kind of look at it from back to front. There is not a single PSG player I could point to as having had a bad game. And that's pretty impressive in a Champions League final. You don't get results like this, Dean, at the highest level. The last time we saw a performance with this kind of domination in it was probably 2011, Barcelona against Manchester United. And even that was 3-1. Like, you go back to Porto's win over Monaco. And before that, you have to go back to, like, the great Milan side of the 90s and their domination of Barcelona at that stretch. Like, this is a result. We haven't seen a team concede 5 goals in a Champions League final since 1962 when Benfica beat Real Madrid 5-3. And even that was 5-3. Like, this is just, we're in unprecedented territory. And I think the scariest bit was 5-0 probably was a little bit of a service to Inter. Like, Barcola missed a couple of key chances. And towards the end of the game, it was like PSG were just playing keep ball rather than try and kind of pile the misery on further in that last sort of 5-10 minutes. The referee blew up at 90 on the dot as if this was a school game between two teams in a cup in different leagues. You're getting olé'd by the fans at 60 minutes because you can't touch the ball. That's not a beating. That's a demolition.
It was, mate. Yeah. You know, Farmers League, eat your heart out. Like, not too bad a league after all, is it? I've definitely mocked PSG throughout the years. And I've been harsh on them. I think they've deserved a lot of it. But I've totally changed my tune across the course of this season because this is a side that were easy to fall in love with because they play game in a beautiful fashion and they use players that you wish to do well. And that is very hard to hate. I'm not sure, like, one of my friends was in France. I think he was in Montpellier. And he said, he messaged our group and he said, lads, this is utterly bizarre. Everyone wants PSG to win and everyone's buzzing for this game. He was like, imagine this back home, like the whole country was suddenly behind Man United.
It's probably worth pointing out that Marseille very much wasn't.
No, Marseille wasn't.
In fact, I was talking to a French journalist, actually, who's been on this podcast before, Luke Entwistle from Get French Football News on the radio the other day, and we'll have Luke back, hopefully, at the start of next season for a bit of a Ligue 1 preview. But he was talking about the fact that in Marseille, Inter shirts had sold out in every single shop. Really, really, really made me laugh. And he's exactly the kind of pettiness I can get behind.
Yeah, I like that. But generally, like, they've gone from bad guys to good guys so quickly. Like, I know that there's still the whole sports washing conversation, like, lurking in the background.
And that has to be had at some point. But this is about the pit team on the pitch. And I know that that's the point, right? Like, I'm aware. I'm aware that that's the entire point of the operation. But I'm talking about a PSG side here at this point. And look, that should never be forgotten in the grander scheme of things. And again, this isn't a fairy tale story. They've spent an inordinate amount of money, even when you put it in the context of the last two seasons where the Galactics project has been thrown out the window. The bling bling era has ended. They've still spent 600 odd million. They're still blowing everybody else's wage bill out of the out of the water in France. But equally, ask a Manchester United fan if spending money guarantees you success. It doesn't, because you have to spend it wisely. And Luis Campos has done an absolutely absurd job in building a squad there that is fit for purpose off the back of one which very much wasn't.
And that's it, isn't it? It was a win that gives you hope if your team hasn't been meeting expectations. If you are a Man United fan and you're like, one transfer window is not going to be enough, or two, you know, one season is not going to be enough to transform us. It can be. Like, PSG have transformed themselves. I know they were already winning things and that wasn't necessarily the problem, but they still had an identity shift and moved on to a pattern of winning and playing that actually worked. And I think that that's really interesting. And I also pointed out in the Hot Takes show that it kind of reinforces this feeling that chaos football's on its way. That I think we'll get more teams playing on the front foot. I think we'll see some teams playing 4-4-2 next season. I think we'll see new setups being tried and tested. I think that the days of Guardiola being copied are gone. And hopefully what we get is teams now trying to play like this and being like, do you know what? Let's do what they do. Like, let's study what PSG are doing and find out how we can dazzle people. Now, obviously, you need certain types of players in order to do that. But look, if we'd have had a PSG-Barcelona final, it probably would have been fitting for the season because that would have been it would have been a basketball match if they were going at each other in the way that they could have. Unfortunately, Inter couldn't turn up on the day. They didn't play like a team that deserved to be in a final, unfortunately. And that, you know, their fans were let down in the late stages of the season. But PSG, just, it's hard to go into critiquing Inter Milan and where they went wrong when all you want to do is talk about how nice it was to watch a team play and win in the style that PSG did. 5-0 could have been more. Like, that's unbelievable. It was truly unbelievable to watch that game. It was like watching Germany-Brazil way back when you kind of sat there, you're like, they've scored a seventh? I was like, that's kind
of a similar fallout in the stands as well, because you saw the images of the Inter fans at the end, you know, kind of like in floods of tears, being like, how could this happen to us? You know, and yes, they haven't been the defensive heavyweight in recent rounds of the Champions League that they were in the league stage. And I think that the end of a long, long season has ultimately got to them in the end. But even still, you know, at that point, you know, at what point does your mindset switch if you're Inter, right? From being, can we claw ourselves back into this, to how do we stop ourselves being embarrassed? And that is a really, really strange moment to get to in a final, because, you know, if you're 4-0 down with, I don't know, 15 minutes to play, right? Do you just be like, there's no way we're going to score 4 goals? Like, do we have to just batten down the hatches and accept the fact that we've been beaten by a better team today? Look, Inzaghi said that afterwards. There's been no doubt about that whatsoever. And being like, we should stop conceding, because it felt like Inter were kind of caught in two minds, you know, after the third goal, in terms of trying to get back into it, which you obviously allowed, and you say, look, fair play to them for trying that. But they also left themselves incredibly exposed, and PSG were unbelievable at doing that. The other thing that I think is interesting, actually, there's a few things, but is the fact that Inter were behind for what, all of 15 minutes, less, 9 minutes in the Champions League ahead of this game all season long. They are not a side built for chasing games. They're a side built to keep themselves in a position of power and try and hold on to it. And the thing about PSG, which I was kind of talking about before the game, but wasn't quite sure exactly how it was going to play out, was if they got their noses in front, the thing is with PSG and this PSG side under Luis Enrique is that they're able to do a couple of things really, really well. They can suffocate you. They can keep the ball and just make sure that you have nowhere to go. They press like absolute demons. And we saw that throughout the entire game, really. But also, if you come onto them, they'll kill you on the counter because they have that transitional approach. And what I was kind of wondering was, if the game opened up, PSG were going to try and exploit those spaces. And exactly what we saw in the second half, in a way that, and when we're kind of watching them, and I know that people will point to games, you know, like the Aston Villa game, where they were given, you know, a firm test by Unai Emery's side and kind of came through by the skin of their teeth. The Arsenal game, where they were probably outplayed between the boxes, but were just far more effective in both boxes, which is, you know, a win within itself, but fine. You can point to that and say that wasn't their best performance. But in terms of when they're on their day and when they're on it, like, I don't see a way that you can get through them. I don't see a way that, and this isn't to say they're going to dominate football for 10 years or anything like that. I know this is the youngest team in the Champions League knockout stages. I get all of that. But, you know, when Barcelona started in the 90s and people were like, wow, this team is going to dominate for 10 years, they didn't. Barcelona side, which, you know, won it in 2011, what, they reached one more final in the next decade? Like, European football doesn't work like that. And it's worth pointing that out. That it's not, this isn't us saying PSG are going to win the next 5 Champions Leagues. But this side right now, I look at it and I'm like, I'm trying to probe a weakness and I can't really find one.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And you don't really want to find one at the moment because you want to enjoy the way that they play and the well, they enjoy themselves, so it allows you to enjoy yourself when you're watching it. And so you're not so much studying like, oh, but are these fullbacks vulnerable if you try this against them or whatever? And it's like, who cares? Like, look at their midfield. Look at what they've got on the break. Look at the way that they go 1v1 against people. Look at the way Dembele's drifted into these half spaces. And it's just so good to watch. And I think the thing also that has made PSG's success a bit more fun this season is that most people aren't watching PSG week on week on week. So,
well, no, because it's impossible to, because France has struggled with a broadcast deal.
And it's a bit like throwback to old European Cup, right? Where you used to like, when the Champions League, when I was a kid, like you couldn't watch the other leagues. Occasionally you might get a Spanish game or an Italian game on the TV, but it wouldn't be every week. Or if it was, you'd get one and you couldn't choose what it was. And then with PSG, it's almost the same. You're just seeing them on Champions League nights, and even then, you're not going to watch all of them. So suddenly, you're like tuning in with a bit of anticipation. You're like, oh, let's see what they've been up to now. I've been checking out their results online. They've seems like they're doing pretty well. Looked at one stage like they were going to be invincible. But so I think that added a little bit of extra to it. Not ideal for French football that nobody can watch their league, but let's be honest, most
probably
people...
a good thing for French football in that people are now going to be like, you know, where the broadcast deal comes, people will be like, people are going to want to watch PSG. People are going to want to watch this iteration of this side, right?
Well, it's
like,
a chance, isn't it? It's a chance for French football to kind of push the boat out and...
piggyback it a bit.
Yeah, they've got to jump on the back of this and be like, okay, you've all laughed at us for quite a few years now and we're the champions of Europe. We're the best of the lot. Now, obviously, they didn't look like the best of it the lot in the early rounds of the new format of the Champions League. But again, a knock-on effect of their success will be how do clubs now approach the Champions League group stage or league stage next season? Are teams going to care about coming first, second or third in it? Or are they just like, well, let's come.
Right. We've already seen UEFA basically speaking about the fact that they're going to reward teams who finish in the top eight with secondary home ties, because it's something we didn't see this year, which is interesting. I think they're going to have to do that in order to push competitiveness up. But also, I do think this, and it was something that kind of came to me yesterday, is it's a slight like kind of MLS vibe to the fact that there's the Champions League has, you know, eight games in the league stage now, in that you can kind of lose the first three if you make a late charge. And it's a bit like the way that MLS has kind of rewarded teams for charging up the table late and then getting into the playoffs and finding that momentum. And I think that there's probably something in that. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good or a bad thing. It's just an observation as opposed to anything else. But I am intrigued by what that means and how teams approach it next season, you know, off the back of this. Yeah. I would ask you this, right? We've heard the news today that Simone Inzaghi is going to be leaving Inter and going to Al Hilal. Now, this was kind of mooted in the press at the back end of last week before the final, and it's now obviously come to fruition. I'd imagine that this decision has not been made in the last 72 hours, right? Like, it might have been kind of, this is the moment that the things were signed, etc. But I imagine his mind was probably made up before the Champions League final. If anything, I think losing the final would have been more of a kind of imperative to stay in terms of let's finish the job rather than, you know, if he'd won it, he'd be like, well, what else is there left to do here? Like, yeah. I've gone and become a champion of Europe. So yeah. Do you think there's an affection on that? Do you think that's something that would have played on people's minds? Like, it now very much feels like this is the end of an era for this Inter team. Now, there was obviously a kind of part of that beforehand, because there were obviously players coming to the kind of twilight of their career. That's one of the knock-ons of Marotta's situation at Inter, in that he's signed free agents and players who maybe are a little bit older. Experience has been one of the key kind of aspects of this. But, you know, there now does feel like a finality to this. And I wonder if some of that kind of played out on the pitch in terms of like there is the you know, fear or lack of freedom to play that, or this was just PSG being too good.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not it's not ideal, and it wouldn't have been lost on the players going into that final. I mean, I don't totally blame him for taking the job. He's getting paid something like 50 million euros for a 2-year deal. Like, that's...
Yeah, he's going to be the most highly paid coach in the world. Fine.
What a ludicrous, amazing amount of money for him. That's it. Like,
definitely, man, get your bag. Also, like, as a manager, does your stock fall? in 2 years' time, is Inzaghi's stock going to still be pretty high?
That's it, isn't it? It's not like a player who kills 2 years of their career there. You can't really do it. Is it like Inzaghi's? I can't off the top of my head tell you how old he is, but he's not old. I know that. 52? I don't know. I'm going to guess.
Played 49.
49. There you go. Even younger than I thought. So it doesn't matter. 50 million euros at 49 years old to come out the other side of it. Like, he's got ages left. Might have another 20 years in management. But yeah, he said goodbye. He said, thanks for everything on my 4-year journey. Every day I dedicated myself. And every last thought of the day went towards Inter. And I don't think that there's any doubt about that.
No,
but, and in the final, I don't think he made great decisions on the day. I think that that's pretty clear. I think that fears that I had actually in the semi ended up coming through to fruition in the final actually instead. But nonetheless, like Luis Enrique on the other side was the hero of the day and everybody's hero because everybody wanted that story as well. So I think that that was okay. And I think that he kind of can leave the job now, knowing that they still experienced some amazing times together and that it's not, too, I don't think it's too tarnished by the way it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, look, Inter fans will be angry about the kind of manner of the departure, I think. They can be fairly manner. They can be definitely angry about the performance that was put 100% in of on that, the highest yeah. stage. But equally, Inzaghi took over a side that were kind of floundering. And he took them to winning absolutely everything except the Champions League. And he got to the verge of winning the Champions League twice. I think that he can have serious regrets about the first one. I think they were very much beaten by the better side by PSG, but I don't think that was the case for the game against City, where, to be honest, they probably had an argument to be the better side in that final, and that's kind of fine. Like, it is what it is. I think that when you put into account the fact that he's managed to do this whilst making, you know, a profit for the club in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, he's been able to put together some incredible moments. He won the 20th Scudetto, which means that they got that second star on the shirt, which is a pretty incredible achievement in itself. I think he can walk away with his head held mostly high, even if this will be a little bit of blot in the copybook. And obviously recency bias will play a part, but in years to come, I think it will be looked back on as a very, very successful Inter era.
Yeah. One last question for you, mate. My kids both want PSG kits. I think I'll do it.
Yeah, I think you should.
One will get the home, one will get the away.
One with Ramos and the other one with Vitinha.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. I see. I was going to get Kvaratskhelia just for a laugh on Reese's, seeing as he's five, and see if they could fit it on the shirt. But yeah, I like that. That's good.
It is good.
That is good.
You're like little dynamic midfield duo for you.
I'm going to do that. Nice one.
Two mini wizards running around San Diego. You love to see it. Right, we're going to take a break there. I'm going to put the Champions League chat to bed once and for all this season. And we're going to move on to some transfer business. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're turning our heads to transfers. And Dean, you've got a few transfers here in this main ranking, which you're a little bit unsure of, shall we say?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about four transfers that look smart but might flop. Just rolls off the tongue, that, doesn't it? But before I get to those four, I just want to quickly address something that happened today in the hours building up to us recording this, which was a transfer that's not going to happen. But the transfer window did open this week. And one of the deals that was being worked on was for Al Hilal to sign Bruno Fernandes. He's not going. Now, he would have earned 600 grand a week if he'd gone. So I wouldn't have blamed him for taking that. But his decision is to stay. And I think that might be the wrong decision. For United especially, but also potentially for Bruno. Now, in terms of the financial impact, to get £100 million for Bruno now at 30, I think would have been I think that would have been a great time to say, like, thank you for everything. You're going down. You'll actually go down probably as a legend.
Yeah, you're going swinging.
A different legend from the ones of days gone by, because you're... the accolades that we've got are not quite at the same level. But nonetheless, you dragged us through some bad times. But with that money, with the 100 million that they could have got from Bruno, they could have used it to sign two players they're much more helpful slash effective for the next couple of years. What's Bruno gaining by staying apart from a show of loyalty? That's one of my concerns here. Now, he says that a move to Al Hilal would have been easy. He knows the Portuguese players very well that are there, but he wants to play at the highest level and compete for major titles. I can do that and I still want to. But he can't do that. Man United aren't in the competitions next season. Like, they're in the Premier League, but they can't win the Premier League next season. They won't be close to that next season. Be a miracle if they are. Champions League not in it. No European competition in it. So all he can do next season, best case, is win the FA Cup, Carabao Cup, right? And then he's in Europe for the next season anyway. By then he's turning 32. Quite frankly, I think Bruno Fernandes is not as instrumental figure for Man United at the age of 32, considering they want to quickly be getting onto the stage where they're trying to win the Premier League. So I think they might even be looking towards the next phase by then. Maybe I'm wrong. It just feels like this might not be the best decision for everyone, because that money could have bought Edison from Atalanta and an actual decent striker. Go and get Edison and give Osimhen some money to become your main striker. That changes everything for next season. Imagine you've got Cunha and Bermo, Edison and Osimhen. But instead of that, you've got Bermo, Cunha, Bruno Fernandes and, for the sake of it, Mateta.
I mean, I think that would be great from a Manchester United perspective. I don't think it would be great from a Palace perspective, and I don't think JP is going anywhere. So let's be very clear.
I'm just using him
as a placeholder. But like, it is one of those. Look, I can commend, and I thought this when this offer came in. I was like, I don't know if Bruno's going to get an offer of this kind of caliber, or if there's a club in Europe that are willing to pay the money for Bruno, who Al Hilal are, right? I don't think it exists. I think that he wants to stay in Europe, and that's perfectly fine. Like, he wants to stay within that eye shot. He wants to stay within there. And I don't think it's necessarily to do with the 2026 World Cup, because there's obviously players in the Portugal squad who are playing out in Saudi Arabia, but equally he feels that he wants to be knocking around in, you know, one of Europe's top five leagues, let's say, just for posterity, in order to keep himself, you know, in the best possible position for the World Cup. That's fine, right? I'm with you in terms of, is there a level here that Manchester United could have just done with the reinvestment? Now, I don't think that Manchester United can replace Bruno with a player of similar caliber to play in those slots. I don't think there is a player that they could buy. You know, they were talking about going and spending 70 million on Pedro Gonçalves, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do because he is a wonderful footballer and is known affectionately, you know, at parts as mini Bruno, especially when he came into the sporting side. But there's a level there where you're like, well, you're just replacing him with a younger model that does exactly the same thing. The questions I have been about where Bruno plays in this system, because I think he plays best in one of the 10s behind the striker, but he has been utilized more and more as someone who plays a little bit further back in one of the more deep-lying roles. And that's where we saw him play against Tottenham in the Europa League final. It's where we saw him struggle in that game, I think. And that, for me, is the concern from this. It's sort of like, where does Bruno fit, especially if you're bringing in Cunha to play in one of those roles, right? And if you're bringing in Mbeumo, where is he playing? Do they see him as a wing back? I hope not, for what it's worth. Like, do they see him as one of those number 10s behind? Do they see him as the number 9? Because if you're bringing in Cunha and Mbeumo, you know, Amorim has already made it very clear that, you know, the squad needs to be smaller next season because they're not going to be competing on as many fronts. Does that mean he sees Bruno as someone who's playing further back? Is he as instrumental in those areas? I don't think so, but, you know, Amorim will have his own views on that. I just wonder if this was the kind of moment, if you were going to sell this moment. And look, I think that's probably why United were open to it. You know, this has come from Bruno. He's made that decision. And I think United will be pleased. I think Amorim in particular will be pleased that he's not losing his captain and his most instrumental player.
Yeah.
Equally, who wears the armband next year for Manchester United if Bruno goes? Because I don't see a candidate as far
it
as...
It would have been Harry Maguire.
So you're kind of looking at it, and then you're back in that conversation, right? Like, in terms of who's doing what. So from that perspective, I can see why, you know, the United fans are really pleased with this. And if, for what it's worth, if I was a United fan, I would be pleased with this. But I also do see that from a kind of rebuilding the squad perspective, that 100 million could have gone a long way.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the actual ranking. 4 transfers that look smart but might flop. At number four, Rayan Cherki, who hasn't signed yet, but is close to joining Manchester City. I've been writing about Cherki on Give Me Sport for the last couple of months. And Man City were never one of the top teams being talked about. Tottenham were regularly talked about. And his dream move was Liverpool. Cherki really wanted to go to Liverpool. And there was actually a chance of that happening until they set eyes on Florian Wirtz. Now, once Liverpool did get their eyes back on Wirtz, then Tottenham were like, oh, a chance for us. And Cherki's like, yeah, I'll be back later. Yeah, probably be fine, but let me just double check if there's anything else. And then suddenly Man City opened the door. And in he goes, runs upstairs, and he's like, I'm not moving, I'm staying here, right? So Cherki is quite happy now. So Cherki's in the house at the moment. He's just waiting to sign the pieces of paper. A great, great footballer, right? In terms of this guy's footwork, the control that he has over a ball, the way he can drag it back, roll his foot over it, find little angles, the way he can dribble, it's insane. It's why you pay to go and watch football matches. Yeah, I'm concerned. Because can he be allowed to be himself at Manchester City? Can Pep Guardiola resist the urge to change him and knock this out of him? Now, sometimes I think that Pep gets a bit of a bad rap on this. I don't think he necessarily has done it as much as people make out, but he's definitely done it. And we're going to get into him into this team, probably. Like I've reiterated, he hasn't signed yet. But how does he adapt to the system at Manchester City? How does he adapt to the off-the-ball work at Manchester City? And how does he combine with learning all of these things about the setup of Man City, how English football is different from life in France, but also still be himself and not put his place in the team at risk? Because we see a lot of players go to City and struggle to be as direct and damaging as they would seemingly have the potential to be if they were playing elsewhere. If you look at Doku, for example, like I think Doku could be a much more effective player for City than he's actually been allowed to be. He's not the same player as Cherki, no, but you know, Jack Grealish, Savinho, whatever you want to say, like none of these guys have quite hit it recently. With Cherki, there's also this underlying problem. Because he already has question marks over his name in terms of his character. And with this player, you've already had past managers and current day analysts, and even people like Thierry Henry, questioning and sometimes even criticizing his work ethic, his off the ball work. When you throw into the fact that City have got players like Phil Foden and the ones I've already mentioned that need minutes, want game time, want to get back to their best selves. How's Cherki like be himself, but also fit in and also thrive without putting his place in the team at jeopardy? So that's why I have a slight fear that Cherki comes into the league, should be one of the best players here, but might not become that.
So I have some rebuttals and I also have an extra question because I also am worried about this transfer, but for a very different reason. And right. I think that sometimes you look at a player and it's just sort of wrong fit for a certain manager, right? And I don't necessarily have that here. Pep has expressed a serious interest in wanting to play with him. And actually, I take your point about the likes of Grealish. I take the point about Doku and Savinho to a point, because I think that when you see players like them, they're kind of in full flow in transition, right? They're players who really do like carrying the ball in space, squaring up an opponent one-on-one. And look, we've seen flashes of that from Doku, especially one-on-one. But I think in terms of him like herring down the wing and getting away from players, you don't see that as often because City like to suffocate teams, right? That's the way that they play. Now, I have less of a concern with that about Cherki because he's a really, really good intricate player in small spaces. And that's a recipe at City in particular that players have really thrived. You know, you look at your Bernardo Silvas, for example, and his kind of cuteness in those areas, his ability to find a space or find a pass when everything in front of him looks blocked, has been one of the key elements of his succeeding. Now, on the other side of that, you have his incredible work rate, which is why he's Pep Guardiola's most used player at Manchester City. But I do think that in that aspect, Cherky's fit is better. My problem with this is similar to why I had a bit of a problem with them going in for Wirtz in the first place. I don't think there's a space for him.
Yeah.
Omar Marmoush's best position is central with an, you know, another striker to play off in that number 10 role. I've had major concerns for a while about Cherky playing wide. Now, perhaps City flip their script a little bit next year. Perhaps we see fullbacks going back in there to try and bring the width and those wide players tuck inside. But you talked about Phil Foden there. He's another one that feels like this kind of sort of number 10 stroke wide player, but is never as effective in these wide areas as he has been in central roles. So, how are you getting all of these players? I think Marmoush is another one. How do you get Marmoush, Cherky, and Foden into this team unless you play them in a really narrow three and you have fullbacks bombing on either side? That is the only way that I can see this working. And look, maybe that's what Pep Guardiola is going for. Maybe Pep is about to go back to fullbacks really stretching the pitch. Maybe we're going to see a real change in strategy there as opposed to the inverting inside that we've seen in recent times. And maybe that's going to be a change that allows this to happen. But I think that, you know, some of the things about Cherky have been overblown. I think there have been issues with managers, but that's not necessarily all down to one personality. It takes two to tango in those scenarios. And I think it's overblown for a variety of reasons. But one, I think everyone was really, really hoping that he was going to be the next big thing. And it's never really quite materialized at Lyon, brilliant as he has been in patches. My issue is more where he fits as opposed, like on in terms of the actual team sheet, as opposed to exactly how this works. Because I think if you get him in the ball in those small spaces that City do like to occupy, he's going to be a threat and he will be able to create from those areas.
Yeah, you're right. As long as he, let's see what position he can take up in that team, because that will determine exactly how influential he can be and whether he can be the maverick that we want him, we want to see in the Premier League if he lands. At number three, I've got Liam Delap, who's joined Chelsea for £30 million. I understand why he chose Chelsea. I think the opportunity to go into a club where Cole Palmer already plays and he knows Cole Palmer from when they were both at Man City. Enzo Maresca, the coach of Chelsea, used to be in the Manchester City system, so he knows him too. So I understand identifying that. I think that given that Nico Jackson is less than convincing and Chelsea haven't had another strong enough option at the nine, would have been a reason to strongly consider this. And you see that Chelsea just often don't score enough goals and just don't have someone that can take it into their own hands or just finish half chances. And I think Delap would have fancied himself to do that. But there's a few things that concern me. The main thing is that they're being linked with Hugo Ekitike, who's €100 million. Well, why? If you sign Liam Delap, I'm not saying that Liam Delap should be like guaranteed to start every game, by the way. I don't think that that's the case. I think that he should be made to work for his place. But there's always been talk coming into this transfer window that Chelsea could sign two centre-forwards. And well, yeah, they've got a lot of competitions coming up next season. You've got Nicholas Jackson. If you have Hugo Ekitike in the mix as well, then that's going to make life a lot harder for Liam Delap, who's just had his first Premier League season, got 12 goals, but still needs plenty of minutes to get up to being his best version of himself in this league. Equally, how does he fit into the style of play at Chelsea and flourishing in the way that I loved seeing him at Ipswich? One of the things that I loved about Delap from the past season was the way that he exploited spaces. Like, the powerful driving runs that this guy can make are unbelievable. Like, I love it. And I love the confidence, the strength that he has to shrug people off, the nonchalance almost at times. And I think that combined with Palmer opening spaces up for him could be great. But will he definitely be able to play positionally in the way that he did on the break for Ipswich? Then there's the risk of playing time. Then there's the risk of developmentally being able to flourish. And then there's the expectation factor. Because if he does get put into a rotation system of the games and the goals don't come early on for him, and suddenly he's got a new weight on him. And it's like, I haven't got long to turn this around or I'm out. Because we know that that can be the case. And I don't think any Chelsea fan, I think Chelsea fans will be happy with this signing, but I don't think anyone's like, oh, this is going to bang. I'd already said going into the transfer window, I didn't think Liam Delap was the answer for Man United. I thought it was a good value deal, but I was like, he doesn't take you from being 16th to 6th. That's not enough. We haven't seen enough. He's a very, very good player, but there's still some ways to go. And so stylistically, is there a match? Is there going to be too much competition for places? And does he take his chances early on if and when they come? Those are kind of my concerns. And it could be so quick to go that he falls away. And I hope it's not the case. I genuinely do hope it's not the case because I wished well for him. But I am concerned that this might not go the way that it could have if he went to another team where he was guaranteed to be more the main man.
Yeah, I think that's fair, right? Like, you know, we heard from, you know, sources close to Liam Delap earlier on that he was looking for somewhere where he was going to go and start 30 plus games in the Premier League next season. I don't think he's guaranteed that at Chelsea. And I think that is a concern. I think, though, you know, I know there are concerns about the fact that he's, you know, been in a team that he's been allowed to play in transition. Chelsea have got, you know, that ability to play in that way. I think Chelsea fans will love Delap because what you're looking at is a physical striker who is able to hold the ball up, who has a player, you know, has that kind of physical profile where he's going to wrestle with defenders. He's going to get into those kind of boxing matches. And he's someone who gets his shots away really, really early, which I think is good for a team like Chelsea. Now, does that mean that he's the best player in the world? No. And is he going to get these opportunities and potentially he's going to be frustrating at times? Of course he is. He's, you know, he's a player who's got a lot of room to grow, but he's still a young player and he's had one season in the Premier League. So you're looking at that from that perspective, and I think it's a risk. But I do think he fits. My major concern with this one is minutes, right? That's the one place I do look at this and think, would he have been really good going to an Everton at this point? You know, would he have been really good walking into a team where he's just going to be the starting striker guaranteed for the entire season, barring injury? Whereas I don't think he has that with Chelsea because of the whole Nicholas Jackson thing. Look, maybe Jackson goes wide next season. And I know that Chelsea now have Champions League football to contend with, and therefore they need more reliable options to be able to rotate. You can't look at the whole squad and the same squad for the entire season if you're doing that. Fine, no problem. But I do worry that Maresca doesn't see Jackson as a wide forward. It's not something we've really seen anything of over the course of this season. And maybe that's because there have been a lack of other options. We didn't see much of Mark Gyu, sure. But actually, what this looks like for Delap, I think we'll have a better idea of sort of 5-6 games into the season. But I am less concerned about his fit because I think that Chelsea fans will love him and his style because of the kind of player that he is and the kind of football that they have seen in successful eras at Chelsea. So I have less concerns about the fact that people might not turn on him because I think his style will endear himself to the fan base pretty quickly, especially at the Bridge. Mm-hmm. I do have concerns about the fact that he might not get as many minutes as he wants and he might not get those consistent runs in the team. That is a potential concern at this point in his career, but I can also see why Chelsea pulled the trigger on this so early.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a good value deal. From Chelsea perspective, there's nothing to lose. It's just for Delap that I feel there might be something to lose. We'll see. Number two is Job Bellingham. I think this is brave. So as we're recording this, he hasn't signed for Borussia Dortmund, but talks are well underway. He's kind of decided that that's where he wants to go. There's a valuation on him of 30 million euros in terms of that's what they want to pay. Sunderland are like, give us a bit more. So we're in negotiation stage about that. Obviously, there are people that feel that this is not a good idea for Job Bellingham because he should forge his own pathway. I spoke with people about this at the end of last week, and when the story started to break about him going to, you know, Frankfurt were on the table and Dortmund were on the table and started to look more like he was going to go to Germany. And I was like, well, surely he won't go to Dortmund. Like, he's not going to, he's going to live in his brother's shadow. And they were like, but look at it from this perspective. How cool would it be if he didn't flop there? How cool would it be if he actually did follow the path that was set by Jude Bellingham and did live up to it, and that they would have the two lads go into that club at such young ages and like become like household names and break through and become, I don't know, Dortmund legends is probably too strong a term, but you know what I mean. So they love that. And actually, from watching what happened with Jude, Job loved the way that they went about developing and how quickly he went from very good to great, right? But I think we just got to be the thing that concerns me is that Jude Bellingham was better than Job Bellingham. That's what concerns me. When Jude Bellingham joined Borussia Dortmund, he was already being hyped as a wonder boy. He was 17. Jude Bellingham is joining, if it goes through, he joins Borussia Dortmund at the age of 19, which of course is very young, like still very young. But by this stage, Jude Bellingham had two seasons under his belt at Borussia Dortmund and was like, the player, Dylan had a Bellingham kit that season, Dortmund kit, Bellingham's name on the back. Like he was the boy. And I've never really heard Jude Bellingham hyped in the same way. He's a different player. He's a different type of... He's a more versatile player, plays a few different roles. I just don't think he's got the impact potential that Jude Bellingham had. And because the comparisons are impossible to avoid, I'm concerned from an outside perspective how he is now judged. And that he might be perceived as a flop. Now, if there's a club that you want to give you some leeway to be on your side and stick by you, then Dortmund could be a good club still. Like they're not going to turn on him. They're going to want him to do well. And he can just, it's valid that he can just go there and be a very good player. He doesn't have to become the star. He can just have a good career at Dortmund. But I just feel that from an outside perspective, that people are going to be expecting more wonderful things of him. And that while Germany might be the right destination for him, Dortmund wasn't. That will be my concern if this goes through.
I'm tempted to agree with you. I think if I was Joe...
I didn't think you'd like... I thought you'd be banging on like, no, like...
No, look, I'm absolutely... I'm convinced that Joe Bellingham can forge out a very good career in his own right, right? He might not be Jude, that's fine. Like, but you're always going to get these comparisons. And for someone who changed the name on the back of his shirt at Sunderland in order to avoid comparisons to his brother... Going to Borussia Dortmund, to me, whilst it will feel comfortable and whilst there's obviously a relationship with the family and whilst he'll obviously be able to speak to his brother and be like, look what they did for me, they could do the same for you. I just feel if you're going that far out to try and change your identity and make sure that everyone knows you're your own man, moving to the same club as your brother went to feels a bit of a strange one in that regard. Like, I don't know if this is a pick a lane because he's a teenager and obviously he's probably a bit conflicted about all of this, right? Like he's like, I'm not my brother, but also my brother did great things there. Like it'd be cool if I did great things there as well. Like obviously you can have numerous things going on, but if you're changing your shirt name to try and avoid it, then going to the same club feels like a weird thing. And I think the Eintracht would have been a really, really cool destination, right? You're still getting Champions League football. You're in a really good club that's in a very good place. They play with a two in midfield that I think you'd be able to work with, but also, you know, players further up that maybe you could impress yourself on in that angle as well. The idea, you know, and obviously the reports coming out of Germany are that he basically was like, nah, I don't want to go here. When it came to Frankfurt, it wasn't that the Eintracht turned him down or pulled out the deal. Yeah. He decided that it wasn't the club for him. And look, maybe he's, you know, seen the facility. He'll obviously have seen the facilities at Borussia Dortmund whilst his brother was playing there. And maybe he's like, it just doesn't stack up in the same way. Maybe it just doesn't work out. But I think if I was Job, and look, again, I hope this works out for him. I really do. If I was him, I think if I was so intent on not being seen in comparison to my brother, maybe I potentially wouldn't have followed the exact same career path in that regard. So, I can see why you've brought this one up.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, I don't want any of these people to flop. I'm just like playing devil's advocate at a time when some deals people are getting very excited about, and that's certainly the case with my number one, which is Matheus Cunha, who has joined Manchester United as their big first marquee signing of the summer. Obviously, talk about Mbeumo joining at the moment too. But Cunha is the one I'm more concerned about. Now, one of the things that I'm concerned of the most is the reaction of Wolves fans to Cunha leaving, because a lot of them aren't actually that fussed. Now, in one sense, they are. I saw some people being like, and that's it. He's gone now. One of the best players, or if not the best player I've ever seen in a Wolves shirt. What a man, blah, blah, blah. Others responded. I've actually got a screenshot here of a guy who tweeted, and he said, his name was Ryan Lester. He said, "Pains me to say it, but Cunha probably is the most gifted footballer I've seen play for Wolves. However, he is miles off it in other departments, especially in terms of mentality and respect. He gave us some very special moments, but also let himself and his team down. We will miss the talent, but we won't miss the bloke." And I was like, oh, that's someone that's watched him every week. And then I read a few more. So I
am very measured when it comes to Wolves as well. I really like his content.
Oh, cool. And so that's interesting. So then I went a bit deeper to see what other people then were jumping in on the back of that. And people were like, look, his talent's undoubted. Won games for us single-handedly. There's no doubt about that. But his professionalism and things like that at times did let us down. The other thing a lot of people keep coming back to, an exceptional individual player. And this is the thing that I'm going to try and work out. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for Man United? That this guy is an individual? Because what I'm concerned about at Man United is, look, they obviously do lack great individuals, and that's the reason they were so rubbish last season. But they also lack any team togetherness, mentality, spirit. They need to build a team. They don't need someone that's going to go and do his own thing. Yes, Cunha can score unbelievable goals. But as I've said a million times before, he outperforms his XG because he scores these worldies. And I'm never sure if it's always going to be repeatable. I think I said the same thing about Bruno Fernandes before he joined Man United when I was looking at the type of goals he used to score at Sporting. So fair enough, because he did come in and start doing it. But there's just so much on this Cunha deal working out. It's £62 million, so it ain't cheap. And there's a lot of talk about, like, this could be the Cantona effect. And Cantona came in and he transformed the club by being an individual, but one that inspired the rest of the team. Is Cunha going to inspire the rest of the team? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Look, I think Mateus Cunha will do fine. For what it's worth, I think that Mateus Cunha will probably get sort of 10, 15 goals in the Premier League next season for Manchester United. I think he is a perfectly good signing in that he fits the system. And I bang on about this a lot, but like, and look, it's one of the reasons I have my doubts about the Shirky deal, right? Like, is there a place for him in that side? With Cunha, I have no such concerns. Like, there is obviously a place for Mateus Cunha in this Manchester United side. It makes sense from that perspective. Yeah. Kind of player who has played in pretty much, not this exact system, but has played in this role for Vitor Pereira at Wolves and should walk in and nail down one of those two roles behind the striker, which is what Amorim wants from a player in those positions. Fine. Absolutely no bother whatsoever with that. I think that's a good fit from that perspective. And I think from a, you know, kind of talent perspective, he'll be absolutely grand as well. Players, people will like watching him play. People will like take to the fact that he's a bit of a kind of maverick in those roles. And I get that. My concern has been, you know, kind of all season long, I've been banging this drum, but especially after the Europa League final, that United needed to get to a place where they were looking at it and thinking, you know, okay, how does this shake out? Because you get to that point where you're not in the Champions League anymore. You are no longer a side who can kill teams in transition, because that was what they were before and they were able to execute at key moments in that. But they're trying to come away from that. They're trying to build a side that is able to do both, you know, to go both ways with and against the ball. And I think that's what they brought Amorim in to do, because that Sporting side were excellent at this. They could play against the ball, as we saw in the Champions League. They could play with it, as we saw domination on a domestic level. I think that's what United are trying to replicate here. So when you're looking at what kind of players United should have potentially signed this summer, there's going to be a lot of excitement about these names. I think Mbeumo is a good fit because he's a player that's coming in still hungry, still with a point to prove, right? But who has proved that he's done it in the Premier League. And you can point to Cunha as saying, well, okay, he's not really won the trophies in England that perhaps he wants to, right? So there's still a level of pull for playing for a club like Manchester United, where not only is your kind of brand deals, etc., about to go through the roof because Manchester United are still one of the biggest clubs in the world, but also you have that opportunity to compete for trophies in a way that you didn't do at Wolves or in this case Brentford for Mbeumo. So I can understand why players still want to join Manchester United. And I know that's been a conversation topic over on social media recently. I don't really buy that. I think there's still loads and loads of pull in that regard. What I struggle with is if you're Manchester United, if I was, you know, running the transfer policy this summer, I would have been looking for players. I think Delap felt like a relatively good fit in that regard because he's someone that comes in and goes, okay, I'm going to pull this up by the bootstraps in order to actually get this club back to where it should be or where they feel it should be. And I think you were looking for players like that who are willing to run themselves into the ground in order to take this club back to, you know, higher echelons. It's not going to be immediate. It's going to be step by step. United are not going to turn around and compete for the Premier League title next year, as you said right at the top. But I think that you kind of want players who are coming in knowing that they're not immediately going to do that. They're going to have to work in order to take the club back to a level where it's competing again. Mm. And Cunha doesn't fit that bill for me. So I take this all with a pinch of salt because I do think that Cunha will fit and I think he'll be fine from a first season perspective at the very least. Is that going to be the keystone to United re-establish himself long-term at the top? I can't see it.
Yeah. Interesting. I thought I might have got a bit more fight back from you on some of these points today, but
I had rebuttals on all of them, but it's just in terms of I have my own concerns about them that are slightly different to yours.
Yeah, exactly. But they are four transfers there that are huge, are all great players, and if they're joining your team, you should definitely be excited. You definitely should. But just be warned. Just be warned, especially the Man United one, because you've been burned so many times before. Feel free to go and get your Cunha 10 shirt at the start of the season because it's a great one to have. But hopefully this one turns out better than the Mount one that you bought a couple of years back.
Yeah, I think it'd be cooler if you got Mateus 10 on the back. That'd be a big flex, right?
Like, yeah,
We'll see how we go. Right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I've got a couple of more bits that I just want to discuss before we go. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC for our third and final part. And this can be relatively short theme, but I've just got a couple more deals I wanted to get a quick kind of sense check on from your perspective. And I wanted to kick off with the Benjamin Sesko deal to Arsenal, which looks like at the moment it's going ahead. Now, not necessarily that it's done or anything like that, but it feels like that Sesko has become Arsenal's primary target. It's a big, big fee. And this is one that I'm a little bit surprised you didn't bring up because this is potentially the transfer I have the biggest reservations about at the price that it is. Because there are players out on the market. We've talked about Victor Gyökeres before. And look, I like Sesko, but I am concerned that he's quite a one-dimensional footballer. And I think in a market where Gyökeres would have been cheaper than Sesko, and we talked about this a little bit on an episode a couple of weeks back, so I don't want to go through the whole thing again. I'm just interested on, one, what you've heard about this transfer and, two, how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I didn't put it in there is because I'm more skeptical still about it actually happening. Now, it might well do, but I think the four that I mentioned, I'm pretty sure have happened or that they almost certainly will. And with Sesko, I didn't feel we were quite close enough to the here we go on it. I think I talked in one of our recent episodes about the fact that I personally would go for Gyökeres. I think it's his goal scoring record for me is too good to ignore. And I do think it's a gamble. My personal take is it's the wrong choice if you go for Sesko over Gyökeres in that Arsenal setup. But the argument will be made the other way that Sesko gives them a profile of player that they do not have in the squad and that I don't say that Kai Havertz is like really similar to Gyökeres, but that he can, their roles would be kind of seen as similar. Like, I don't particularly agree with what I'm saying there either, but that's the case that has been put to me is that to rotate between Havertz and Sesko is more difficult to plan for who you, what you're getting than if you're getting Havertz or Gyökeres up against you. I don't know. I don't know if that's really true, to be honest, because I say, well, that's fine because Havertz ain't going to be playing there, Gyökeres is.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's a valid concern. And I think there is a valid concern that when you're talking about Gyökeres, he's not had to play against kind of the ultra defensive low blocks in the Premier League in the same way that he has to in the Primera, right? Because Sporting are so good at actually stretching teams that, you know, we are looking at something slightly different in that respect. So if you're looking for a striker who's got a box profile, then perhaps Šeško fits better in that regard. Mm. I'm concerned that his big strength is it just hits the ball really hard. And I know that's obviously oversimplification, but like I watch him quite a lot and I'm like, he takes shots on from like ridiculous positions at times. And I'm like, sometimes they go in and they look unbelievable because he struck one from 35 yards and it's arrowed into the top corner. But when there's like five players in front of you, I'm like, that's obviously not the right option every time just to leather it. And like, I don't know, variation on shot profiles, like his inability to kind of do different types of finishes. It all just sits a little bit uncomfortably for me. Now, look, there is a high chance that he comes in and he's excellent, right? I'm not saying this is a guaranteed disaster by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever. I just have concerns. And look, maybe that can be coached out of him and maybe they feel as a player that they can really coach to a higher ceiling. And that is a fair point. But I just think if I was spending that kind of money and I was looking to take the final step that Arsenal are, I would have probably gone Gyökeres at this point as opposed to Šeško. But yeah. Hey, it's going to be very interesting to see how it kind of shakes out from this point. The other two that I wanted to quickly mention are transfers that I really like. And one of them, actually both of them involve Liverpool, one of the in and one out. Jeremy Frimpong coming in at right back. I've thought about a lot and I have decided that I'm hugely in favour of this deal in pretty much every possible scenario. I think that it's something different. He is by no means a Trent Alexander-Arnold clone in pretty much any capacity. But what he gives you from that right-back slot and the ability to get down that flank and cause havoc, I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly how Liverpool line up, especially if they get Kerkez as well on the other side and what that looks like in terms of which is the defensive midfielder dropping in on both sides at that point. Because Gravenberch has done that a lot for Trent, but in a slightly different capacity. If Frimpong is going bombing forward, maybe it allows Salah to go more central. What does that do if Florian Wirtz does come through the door? Are they combining in small spaces? All of this is really, really interesting, I think, from a Liverpool perspective. But Jeremy Frimpong coming in, getting that deal announced hours after the Trent deal was, you know, kind of put through and finalized, I think is excellent business. I think it stops the kind of worry around who comes in at that position. I think in Connor Bradley, there's a perfectly serviceable, more defensive-minded right back. But I do think that Frimpong's defensive ability has been kind of overlooked in all of this. It's something that he's spoken about at length. It's something that we've seen really improve in his game down the years. And I am really, really excited to see him in the Premier League and in this Liverpool team, because I think he's going to become a serious, serious player.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was doing my little list of players I was feared would flop, I obviously wrote down like the most impactful signings that we've seen so far. So Frimpong's name was on the list. And I think it was the first one I crossed off. I just not concerned about it. I think he's great. And I think obviously Liverpool transforming the way they play for next season, and he's going to be pivotal to it.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Final one, an outgoing from Liverpool. And I think this might be the best deal of the window so far, Dean. Kevin Kelleher to Brentford.
Oh, it might be, mate. It might be.
Replacing Mark Flecken, who, look, Mark Flecken gets a lot of plaudits because he makes a lot of saves, right? And he's had some unbelievable games for Brentford. But I listen to Brentford, you know, friends of mine, family of mine speaking a lot of the time, and they have just never really bought the Mark Flecken thing. They're always worried that he's got a mistake in him. We've seen that time and time again. If you watch Brentford week in, week out, that he is not the most cohesive goalkeeper. He's had magical moments nonetheless, but they've never really been comfortable with that replacement for David Raya. He's never really showcased his ability in the same kind of way. Him going to Leverkusen for 10 million and signing Kelleher for, I think it's 13, that could possibly rise to 18, could end up being the bit of business of the window. I think that is an absolutely astounding signing from Brentford. I think it's a brilliant fit. And from a personal perspective, I'm delighted that there's more game time between Nathan Collins and Kevin Kelleher, who are going to be Ireland's starting centre-back and goalkeeper for the next decade. So that's important from my perspective. But I think Brentford might have pulled off the coup of the window here. And they, you know, you add that to the fact that Michael Kayode has been made permanent as well, 13 million. So for 30 million, they've bought one of the best young goalkeepers in the world, and a right back with the potential, I think, to be one of the best right backs in the world going forward. Brentford have absolutely started this window on a hot flush. And I mean, much as it pains me to say it, I think that is an absolutely A-star start to this transfer window for them. I think that is huge business and brilliant business.
Yeah. I mean, Chelsea should have done it at this point. Linked
with Mike Maignan, which would be excellent.
Yeah.
Especially if it's £25 million. That is finally putting the goalkeeper issue to bed.
Yeah. They've been saying, we're not looking for a goalkeeper. We're not looking for a goalkeeper. We've been saying, yes, you are. Yes, you are. Anyway, on Patreon this month, we are doing our new Transfers from Paradise newsletter and podcasts. And Kamin Kelleher did feature in Tuesday's edition. I've had to flip it. I kept writing episode, but doing editions of newsletters. So I got confused. Anyway, Kelleher's in there. I wrote this. Kamin Kelleher to Brentford for £12 million could be one of the bargains of the summer. Mark Flecken to buy Leverkusen for 8.5 is another neat bit of business. But honestly, Brentford might have even upgraded here. And I
don't think there's a question. I think they have definitely upgraded.
Yeah. But Flecken's been good. Like, I'm not like, I like Flecken. But, and when I heard he was leaving, I was like, oh, this is interesting. Flecken's going and Bermo's going. And they replaced him with Kelleher. And I was like, oh, they just got a bit better.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's wonderful business from a Brentford perspective. So shouts out to them and their recruitment team, because that is...
Yeah, the recruitment team's good at Brentford, must say.
Very, very smart indeed. All right. I think with that, it's probably time for us to call it a day. But as you say, far more transfer bits over on the Patreon. They're going to be coming throughout the summer. We'll be dropping episodes of podcasts over there, but also all of Dean's transfer updates. The link in the description as ever. If you'd like to come and join us for the summer, we would love to have you. It's a wonderful, wonderful community, thriving on those Discord servers as well as those extra episodes and newsletters. So make sure you come and have a look. The free trial is still available at the moment. So go and have a look. Click on that link and come join us for the summer. We'd love to have you. But for now, and for us, thank you so much for listening. Thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
Matt Collins, this has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much, as ever, for sticking with us over the course of this season. There'll be loads more over the course of the summer as well. We keep rolling. Football doesn't sleep. Thus, neither do we. Thanks for listening. Take care. Peace.